plenty of chairs, by the way, up in front. If those in the back who are standing would like to move up. Our next speaker, I think, is best described as a man of great moral, as a man of strong convictions and great moral courage. In his native Poland, he told me, he was an editor of the only Catholic magazine permitted, and as such, edited many articles by the present Pope John Paul II. He left Poland, came to this country, and went to work for the New Yorker. It's quite a remarkable achievement, it seems to me, for a man whose native language is Polish, to get a job on such a magazine as the New Yorker. He left the New Yorker, however, and he said that's the most significant part of his connection with the New Yorker, because he didn't agree with its position. He felt that the New Yorker, I guess, was too far to the left, and he went out to Rockford to become editor of Chronicles of Culture, a very important magazine, I think, in the struggle against the wave of pornography, the general degradation of standards in publishing and book reviewing and so on. I'm very pleased to introduce Leopold Tierman.
Thank you, Mr. Egne. I also prefer to stand just in order to match Mr. Harrigan in stature. And so let's go. Let us be frank. Those evocative adjectives, liberal and conservative, have become semantic crutches. They no longer denote judgment, principle, and discernment, but rather preference, mood, penchant, sudden sympathy, immature choice, prefabricated emotion, political directive, econometric estimate. They meant something different at the outset of this century, as well as in the 1870s. Henrik Ibsen then wrote, I quote, "He has the luck to be unhampered by either characteristic or conviction, or social position, so that liberalism is the easiest thing in the world for him." It's unlikely that old mutton-chopped feminist would have ever made it from Greenwich Village to Congress with such a campaign slogan. And he was off mark to boot. Today's liberal is a mammoth pile of convictions, and a social position is the source of his power. But the ease of being liberal is now as it was in Ibsen's time. Oh, how easy, how cozy and beautiful is to be liberal. How inebriating to find the proper faith at the bottom of one's heart. How lavish are the comforts of rectitude. How precious is to feel always enlightened and decent. How safe it is never to leave the side of peace and equality. How rewarding in every respect is to hate exploitation and prejudice. How gratifying it is to luxuriate non-stop in compassion. How reassuring it is to be perennially armed with a correct conscience, superior knowledge, an infallible sense of justice. How soft and snug to be constantly well informed about what's best for the society, man, woman, child, animal, and plant. How secure it is to be responsible always to motivation and never to reality, to defend instinct against reflection and never to peek under the warm blanket of liberal self-adulation. Please don't discount my perfunctory outburst as a verdict on facility. There is a kind of sturdiness in the liberal post-Panglossian fervor, and there is mental gumption in the pursuit of ready-to-wear righteousness. There may be wisdom in the nobleness of causes that are loved at first sight, in synthesizing idealism and optimism into a heady certitude and in distilling fiery commitment from such sour mash. All progressives from Rousseau to Marx to the Institute for Policy Studies have claimed that heaven on earth is possible, and they all promise to do something about it. A shrewdness must be in those ideas, since their consequences have produced for countless societies hell on earth without affecting their marketability. My own deep contempt for them notwithstanding, I must admit that their circulation over the last two centuries has improved many social practicalities, and that their influence is verifiable and measurable and ought not be demeaned. What's unacceptable is their latent absolutism, which turns their defenders into rabid persecutors of anyone's attempt to evaluate those ideas honestly. What the liberal peremptorily rejects is any objective inquiry into the misery, oppression, injustice, tyranny, madness, violence, and crippling misfortunes of the human masses victimized by the implementations of the progressive orthodoxy. These precepts should be judged on the merit of conceptual purity, the liberal intones. His adversaries' unforgivable sin is that they promise very little, thus making anti-liberalism apocalyptically dull. But isn't the refusal to sell a snake oil pledge of happiness for everybody sterling decency rather than conservative boredom? Isn't the liberal more of a crooked caterer of fake ideological fun than the decent guy he clamors to be? So where is our wisdom? It's mainly in our harrowing feeling that the world is crumbling around us and that most liberal ruptures have resulted in a rotting civilization, a debased culture, a fragmented man, and a nihilistic social ethos. We know why the promised garden of liberal superhumanity has transmogrified into the liberal jungle where psychologically excused evil roams free. Ours is the wisdom of torment, which tells us tactfully that if everything inside is decomposing, it is not because of our narrow-mindedness, greed, hypocrisy, prudishness, and mediocrity, but precisely because of their goodness, justness, and magnanimously open minds. We stand accused of wishing to suppress the humanitarian impulse in man, but no one mentions the defaced humanitarianism of the cultures in which homo has been replaced by ego, where the wealth of humanness that took millennia to accumulate has been pulverized into cheap solipsism. Since social perfectionism has ended up in gulags, all those who hate the bourgeois civilization now have a more condemnable enemy than laissez-faire capitalism, namely the normative systems of values which we have inherited from Judeo-Christian and Hellenic wisdom. In our time, the progressive theorists no longer insist on the head-to-head struggles with mechanisms of production or political structures. They pervert them. They have learned that they cannot defeat the human need for religion and tradition, so they declared them arch foes of some fictitious modernity and innocence. Being unable to redefine goodness according to their vacuous gospel, any grand, comprehensive design for a civilization eludes them. Thus, they are forced to draw constantly from our inheritance, and they venomously corrupt and disfigure it in the process of borrowing. Whereas our wisdom tells us simply that the supreme assets of civilizations are not social blueprints, but people. If people are good and live wisely, civilizations thrive. So what are we fighting for? We battle for the human mind, or as they put it, consciousness. We fight for the soul. They fight for a society which they trust will determine the soul. The mere fact that they still believe in such a triviality, in spite of 5 millennia of experience to the contrary, is consoling. All philosophies promise to improve either man or his fate or both. Liberals claim that by bettering his material condition, they'll make man better, soul and destiny included. We cling to the idea that by asking man to be better, we may possibly ameliorate society and thus perhaps man's destiny. In the vocable, perhaps is the crux of our conflict with the liberals. They hate incertitude. They know no hesitation about their non-negotiable precepts. They want to do with and to men only what they deem proper and just. Our wisdom, therefore, makes us suspect that they are ordinary totalitarians and should be dealt with as such. But does our reliance on the conditional drown us in the swamp of relativism? Not quite. The conservative wisdom asks us not to budge on the fundamental notions of repentance, normalcy, and skepticism. Yet at this juncture of history, we are being robbed of them. Atonement is derided as superstition. Politicians and writers who are implicated in murders are hailed as more humane if they do not redeem their sins. Normalcy is ridiculed as a psychological fossil or abused through statistics, while doubt about the liberal wisdom is forcibly banned from the national culture. But conservative wisdom informs us that an organized and free society is doomed without the clarity of thinking, which in turn is impossible without penitence, the marrow of moral order, without norms, our existential guideline, without skepticism, our natural right to free inquiry. Thus, where do we stand with all our sagacity in the universe of modern culture? Whatever sublime virtue there is in our message, we have let ourselves be pushed out the territory where wisdom turns into popular symbols and signals. True, Dostoevsky, Henry James, Conrad, Proust, Kafka, Eliot, Faulkner, the founding fathers of modern consciousness, were all bona fide conservatives. So were Griffith, John Ford, even Charlie Chaplin, that old fellow traveler, if his artistic sentiments are measured against those of current liberal criticism. If there are common denominators for this man's conservatism, it would be their postulate of expiation, their sense of logical norm, their hierarchy of values, all of which would make it rather unprofitable to turn The Sound and the Fury into a Broadway musical or Lord Jim into a pornographic comic strip, as can be done with any Vidal or Vonnegut. Through feminism and the mechanization of sexuality, ludicrously called a revolution, a universe of feeling has been lost. And now it seems that both women and philanderers desperately wish to retrieve it. Life itself meets out punishments that conservative wisdom can rightly foretell as the consequence of false ideas. Yet we cannot creatively articulate an antidote. The liberals keep issuing effective behavioral ukases, which we try unsuccessfully to combat with tedious and trite sermons. Philosophy without wisdom is like playing jazz without syncopation. This is why, rather than with scholastics and materialists, I would have a dry martini or two with Socrates, Pascal, Dr. Johnson, and Voltaire. They all fought the despotism of perverted labels, which alone would have made them contributors to the chronicles of culture today. So if, like Lenin, we ask, what's to be done? My answer would be, first, refurbish our prescription for how to live a rewarding life. A killer tornado demolished our cultural landscape in the 1960s, leaving empty spaces, ruined edifices, and a rubble of ethical standards twisted into caricatures. We mourn our missing valuables, smart integrity, practical optimism, cheerful rectitude. But there is the Woodstock generation out there paying for this radical speciousness, and we must address it with rationality, not dogmas. A new stratum is emerging, perhaps the next American ruling class, the sons and daughters of rednecks and ethnics who, while melting in the pot, got burned by the alchemists of the 60s and were nauseated by chumming with the kids of the wealthy, liberal elites. They grew into media and computer mavens, and they now want to go back and live by Merle Haggard lyrics without relinquishing Masterpiece Theater. They don't know how to reconcile, but so we must tell them, for they are an expanding constituency that is only superficially acculturated to the official modish cliches and not really convinced about the liberal syrup. To my mind, they are ready for a new modified patriotism, a new manifest destiny. When talking to them, we must not confuse morality and mores, as our less sophisticated brethren do, and then wonder why so few listen to them. We must make it clear that we can distinguish between progress and change, freedom and liberation, past values and the permanence of values, and why we do so. We must pledge allegiance to legitimate and sensible human aspirations and gently explain why we believe not in man perfectibility, but in his corrigibility. Whatever we have to say must be turned into an upbeat message that will stress our ability to formulate a pattern for a meaningful existential fulfillment that is a re-evaluated philosophy of life. Once we get that message across, it will occur to many that we, not the liberals, know more about peace of mind, priorities of emotions, and criteria of both joy and dignity, and that our intellectual commodities are of higher cultural quality than what is rammed down their throats by the liberal culture. If we succeed in making our agonies a high drama, our wisdom a fashion, our moral order an elegance, our ethical concerns a snobbishness, our quandaries an excitement, and our ambivalences a suavity, we will have our breakthrough in culture, and it is culture that determines power in a democracy more subtly and enduringly than any other factor. Those who were enchanted with our triumph in 1980 and are now sorely disenchanted do not realize that it was just a political victory, frail and shallow by nature, not a revolution but a tremor that merely shuffled furniture without changing reality. If semiotics has it right, President Reagan seems to have forgotten that his election was a sign, and he seems unaware that now he has been badly desymbolized. Who is to be blamed for his desymbolization? I don't know. I'll never understand why he prefers to fraternize with the pro-communist Demi Monde of Hollywood or the assorted Cronkites rather than to invite Otto Scott, Henry Regner, or Anthony Hargan for dinner. He ignores the fact that by doing the latter, he would embellish his own image, not to mention the net intellectual profit from the conversation. Not long ago, one could read an apt sentence in the Wall Street Journal. Mrs. Thatcher and Mr. Reagan are in office, they aren't in power. That's right, and they won't ever be in power unless they address themselves to the workers in the fields of cultural sophistication, for only their influence and mediation can solidify their ballot gains into a sway over minds, as was once done with Franklin Roosevelt and John Kennedy. Nothing better symbolizes the liberal genius than its most successful exhortation. Go east, young men, marry an heiress, and found a journal of opinion, for only a lot of money will assure the robustness of your liberal catechism. There is a lot of power in dollars earned by the old traditional virtues and then turned into pernicious intellectuality. The older the money you reach, the more madcap the socialism you'll be able to preach. If conservative ideas are deficient in consequences, perhaps it's because we neglect to wangle money from heiresses, who would be willing to give it to us when they became infatuated with our refined charms, and get it instead from business people and politicians who short-sightedly demand instant returns and dividends. After Reagan's ascent, there was a lot of talk about the freshness of our ideas. We now can see those ideas didn't prevail. If they conquer in the future, it will be because the liberal culture is already a dustbin of moral routines and cognitive stereotypes, while we are still moved by moral passions and by the cognitive revelations that things can be so dazzlingly correct and profoundly simple. Once we succeed in translating this wisdom into the language of our time, we shall be consequential winners. Thank you.